This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, hosting its 22nd anniversary celebration and the grand opening of Gazelle Full Circle Resale, also featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men. Both events run June 16th through 25th. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont. Information at 503-288-3422.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizzicato pizza, and all-new seating, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Good morning. My name is Ed Goldberg. I'm here with my friends.
Dawn Taylor.
And
D.K. Holm.
And we're here to talk to you about some movies. I was away last week, so I didn't get to see a whole lot, unfortunately. I had a great time last week, but not in a movie theater. We have
Same with us.
Misfortunately, that's probably true, yes. Let's get right rolling. I'm the only one who saw this. I would kind of wish you guys had seen this as well. This is the Al Gore movie. Documentary entitled An Inconvenient Truth, directed by a guy named Davis Guggenheim. I've seen his museum in New York. It's very nice. It's a bit pretentious. It is, after all, Al Gore, who, is, by the way, is looser and funnier and more relaxed than I've ever seen him, which is still Al Gore. But, you know, he's looking cool, and he knows what he's talking about. He says during the course of this film that he's given this – it's essentially a lecture, a slide lecture. He's given it thousands of times. So he's really, you know – familiar and comfortable with the material. Very informative. The information, whatever lack there is in Gore's presentation, the information is so stunning and horrifying that it just carries the day. Let me put it this way. If even half of what Al Gore tells us is true, we're still in deep, deep trouble, and we really need to do something about it. This is a truly overwhelming piece of documentary filmmaking. You might say it's preaching to the choir, and in a sense it will be, because the only people who are going to see it are the people who believe that there really is global warming, the people who don't believe there's global warming, or that it's just a leftist plot to destroy the infrastructure of the United States. They're not going to see this movie, and they're not going to care what truths there are until the water is bubbling up around their belly buttons, and then maybe they'll think about it. One of the most amazing things to me, in all the statistics and all the presentations and all the film and the words in this movie, this the metaphor of the ice cubes in the glass. If you have a glass of water with ice cubes in it, whatever cubes exist below the surface, when they melt, will not raise the water level. It's one of those interesting anomalies of physics. Any ice cubes above the water level will raise the water level when they melt. So what he's saying is, okay, it's one thing for the ice that's already in the oceans, like the Arctic Ocean, to melt. That won't raise the level of the water. But what happens when the Greenland glacier melts? That's going to raise the water. And he shows pictures of New York and pictures of L.A. and, you know, major coastal world cities and what's going to happen. It's a good thing we live in Portland, because pretty soon we're going to have waterfront property. You know, anybody who listens to KBOO should probably see this movie. They probably don't need me to tell them to go see it, but it's really an amazing piece of filmmaking. I give it a B+. It's definitely worth seeing. Any observations for, you know, just...
Well, I was just thinking what you said about him appearing looser. I remember when he was stumping with Clinton when they were on the campaign trail, he would warm up the crowd for Clinton. Mm-hmm. And he's always he was a very warm, funny, very charismatic man. And then as soon as he starts his own presidential bid, it was like they just pulled the plug on his entire personality for some reason. I really don't know why. But I've seen there's a documentary about him that I can't remember the name of right now, where you get to see him behind the scenes and at home. And he's actually a very, very incredibly intelligent man, but also right. A surprisingly charismatic one. That I don't think a lot of people realize.
It's one of those curious facts about Al Gore is that when he's working for somebody else, He's looser, and when he's working for himself, he just takes on an air of seriousness. Same thing happened with John Kerry. John Kerry turned into a stiff when he went out there on the stump also. Okay, that was an inconvenient truth. I know you're going to see it, so go see it anyway. Don, tell us about the lake house.
Coincidentally, this is a story about waterfront property. It's a tale of Sandra Bullock and Keanu Reeves, who play two people who are residents of a gorgeous sort of Mies van der Rohe, Frank Lloyd Wright-inspired glass lake house, and they start communicating via mail, and it turns out that they are actually living 2 years apart, and they're quite taken with each other, and they fall in love, but their mailbox is magical somehow, and they can slip notes to each other in the mailbox, and then the other one gets it, like, in their own time frame. And this is... it sounds horrible. That just sounds horrible. I got Keanu Reeves, Sandra Bullock, Magical Mailbox. But surprisingly, it's directed by an Argentinian director who, that is the one film that I forgot to bring my notes on, so I cannot remember his name. He is the director of Valentine, which came out a couple of years ago, which was a very good film. And he does a wonderful job of creating romantic tension in a story basically about two people who have not met. And... it's really very well done. It's not sappily over romantic. It's not. It's very nice. The score is awful. It's undercut a bit by just really horrible music by Rachel Portman, and an ending that's a little bit illogical. But surprisingly, for a film with Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock about a magical mailbox, it's actually quite good. And I give it a B. I liked it quite a lot.
Well, I think we've all had the experience of putting something in the mailbox and having to get there 2 years later. I mean,
but getting it there 2 years earlier—that's
the trick. Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry, we can't process your bill because it's way too early. Yeah.
So this is a film in which two very popular movie stars who have appeared in movies before don't actually meet until the last 15 minutes of the movie.
They actually do have a meeting. He's knows what's going to happen, and he's 2 years earlier. So he's actually able, at one point, he has an opportunity to meet her. But she, of course, does not know him yet. So that makes for a very interesting scene.
Oh. She's looking for Tom Hanks, or...
I don't know. Yeah. The really frustrating thing is you keep wondering why she doesn't send him lottery numbers or something.
Or horse racing.
They never think of that.
Okay, that was The Lake House. Did you give it a grade?
B.
B, okay, that'll do. Evil. Doug, tell us about Evil.
Evil is a movie that's playing or about to play at the Hollywood Theater. It's an interesting film in that it was a 2004 Oscar nominee for Best Foreign Film. And it is directed by Michael Hafstrom, who you may know from that light masterpiece, Derailed, that starred Jennifer Aniston and Clive Owen.
That was a terrible movie.
Yes, well, The Evil is somewhat better than that. They're actually kind of similar. They're both stories about a person driven as far as they can be pushed by an evil person until they finally turn. So it's kind of an unofficial remake of Billy Jack, I guess. In this case, though, it's set in 1950s boarding school, where the main character is a guy who's an expert swimmer, but he has a problem with violence because he has a history of violence, because his stepfather has a history of violence, and he ends up in the school where the usual stuff you get in this kind of school movie, bullies, upper level guys, boss around the younger guys. But the extremes they go to in this movie are really A, amazing, and B, disgusting. So you're basically waiting around in this movie until the worm turns. And when it happens, it's pretty satisfying. But it doesn't seem like a Swedish movie. It seems like an American movie. Maybe that's why Hafstrom ended up making a movie here. But in any case, it is I found it to be surprisingly well done, not quite as gripping as I was hoping it would be. And one interesting thing about it is when the movie ends, they really want you to know what happens to everybody so that you have a completely, there's no suspense, there's no cliffhanger, there's no, just everybody's methodically explained and packaged and put away. I give it a B minus. I think it's good, it's not great, and it's very well acted, and just a little deficient in the narrative neighborhood. Don, did you see this too?
Ed, did you want to say something about it first?
Well, go ahead.
I got a chance to see it. And it was interesting for me because I got a DVD screener and I watched it at home. And my husband asked what it was. And I said, I don't know. I had no idea what this film was going in. And I started watching it and I was in a few minutes. And I said, oh, it's like Dead Poets Society, only they're Swedish. And he was like, ah. So he ran off into the other room to play a computer game. And then he came through the room a little while later and took a look at the screen and stood there for a few minutes and watched. And then he left. And then something happened, and he said, what happened? And I told him what happened, and he came out, and he watched it for me. And by the last third of the movie, he was perched on the edge of this ottoman in my living room just watching the movie because we both just got completely sucked in by it. Andreas Wilson, the lead character, it's his first film he's ever been in, and he's just magnificent. He really is marvelous. It's all very by the numbers, bad stuff happening at a boarding school movie. We've all seen this movie over and over again. And yet, it's so competently done. And the actors are so good that even though I could see where it was going, I've seen this movie before. I really, really enjoyed it. I give it a B+. I was surprised by this film. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, I agree with you. I expected it to be one kind of a movie, and it turned out to be another kind of a movie. One of the things that this film does is explore class in a way that American movies generally don't do, because class is the thing that drives this whole thing. The upperclassmen in this movie are not only upperclassmen giving them the ability to haze the underclassmen, they're also rich kids. And when anybody comes in who's either a scholarship student who's coming by sports, which is what the lead character is, or is different because they're smart or Jewish or, you know, there's a huge holdover of, it takes place in the 50s. There's a huge holdover of World War II venom in this. And the thing is, all the music in the film was American pop music from the 50s. They listen to Elvis. They listen to R&B from the 50s. These kids are soaked in American culture, and yet they have this monocle, Heidelberg dueling scar mentality. And it's truly amazing. I'm thinking, who should watch his kids? And this is okay, despite the violence. This is okay for a mature high school age kid, because these are just the kind of kids who need to see this. This is an exploration of class like we don't do in this country, because we don't perceive of ourselves as having classes like this in this country. After this administration, it might be different. I gave the movie a B+. I really think it's worth seeing. It's entitled Evil. We all kind of liked it, right?
Yes.
Okay, now I didn't see The Breakup, Dawn. Tell us about The Breakup.
The Breakup's an interesting film. It's directed by Peyton Reed, who directed Bring It On and Down with Love. And it stars Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston. And it's it's an interesting film. They play a couple who, at the very beginning of the film, you see them meet, then a quick montage of them falling in love and moving in together. And then they have just one of those stupid fights like couples have that essentially brings out all of the dissatisfaction that they have had with each other up to this point. And they decide, slam bam, just like that, they're going to break up, except that they're sharing a condo which they have purchased together. And neither of them can really move be the one to move out until they sell it. So they're kind of stuck in the apartment together, which is a pretty standard setup, I think, for a comedy of this sort, except that much like with Bring It On, Peyton Reed kind of alternates between comedic stuff, which is usually given over to the secondary characters in this film, like Jon Favreau. Joey Lauren Adams is her best friend. And Vince Vaughn and Aniston, their characters, their scenes together are surprisingly authentic, very angry, very, very well written, nasty arguments. And so it's a kind of a schizophrenic movie, which has turned off a lot of reviewers. I liked it. I liked that schizophrenic quality to it. I liked the fact that they actually addressed in an adult way the horrible things we say and do to each other in the course of breakups, the embarrassingly awful things that we are capable of when we're in that kind of pain and we want to hurt another person. And it's lightened up a great deal by the secondary performances. I liked it quite a lot. I can see why a lot of people didn't. They walk in expecting a wacky, zany Wedding Crashers type comedy, and it's not that at all. It's a very adult film and surprisingly mature. Peyton Reed's an excellent director, and I think we should all keep an eye out for whatever it is he does in the future. I gave this a solid B. I liked it quite a lot, and despite myself, I didn't expect to. And give it a chance, if on DVD, if nothing else.
Doug, did you see this?
I did not.
Okay, let me ask you a question, Don. When you describe this film, I think of the War of the Roses.
It's not as black and it's not as nasty as War of the Roses.
Well, that's the thing. Now, War of the Roses was a vicious, evil satire. Right from, I mean, when I reviewed that movie, I said, why doesn't Danny DeVito just hang himself and get it over with if this is his view of the human race? This is not quite that dark.
No, it's not that dark. In this case, it's actually the you get more squirming in your seat when you're watching them have at each other, because the stuff they say rings so true. It's not over the top like War of the Roses was. And while much of the things, there is humor in their fights at times, mostly it's just there's this kind of uncomfortable sense that you get watching this of like, oh, I've been there. I've had this conversation. And, oh, that's ugly.
Okay. All right, so that was The Breakup. I kind of wish I'd seen it now. Doug, tell us about Blackballed, the Bobby Duke story.
That is another movie from about 2 years ago, 2004. It is Brant Cerson's mockumentary that stars The Daily Show's Rob Corddry as a disgraced paintball player.
The mind reels at the concept.
The movie posits or pretends that paintball is on the level of World Cup soccer or American football, and instead of like dodgeball, which is its cinematic analog. And 10 years ago, Bobby Dukes was caught cheating. What he did was he wiped, and apparently in the arcana of paintball, that's where you are hit by a pellet and then quickly try to wipe it off before anybody sees that you've been hit. This is with a grotesque sin in this world.
It's the equivalent of corking the bat. As
yes. So he goes. He travels the world like a character from a Somerset Maugham novel for about 10 years. Comes back and tries to get back into the game. As in dodgeball, gets the usual ragtag group of dissonant people to be on his team, and then goes on. He gets to what happens. And again, it's done in a mockumentary style. Which sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. The people who are in it are from the Upright Citizens Brigade comedy troupe. Are you familiar with them? And Ed Helms is a small part, also from The Daily Show. I didn't find it to be that funny. I wrote down one line of dialogue. One character says to Rob Corddry, "I would take a bullet for you, but I can't take a paint bullet for you." That's about the level of the humor that
Ouch.
You get. And it's from, and it's because it's improvised. We could do a whole show on what I think about improvisation, but in this particular case, it works sometimes, but it never really feels real. That's the problem with it. So I think it's okay. Corddry does a kind of funny Henry V type speech, trying to get his troops up for the final war. But for the most part, scenes go on too long, scenes go on too unrealistically, and they also, unfortunately, go on too unfunnily. So I give it a C-plus for effort, but it certainly doesn't reach the heights of some of the Christopher Guest mockumentaries.
I have a question. When you do this show on improvisation, is it going to be scripted, or are you going to make it up as you go along?
I'm going to write it all down first and read it very slowly and carefully.
Okay, now here's another movie I missed. Dawn, tell us about Keeping Up with the Steins.
Keeping Up with the Steins is directed by Scott Marshall, son of Gary Marshall.
Aye.
And it's about a young boy played by Daryl Sabara from Spy Kids, who is turning 13, and he's headed for his bar mitzvah. His father is an agent, played by Jeremy Piven, who also plays an agent on Entourage, so apparently that's what he does now. And he and his wife, Jamie Gertz, are planning the bar mitzvah. And because an ex-business partner, now rival of Dad's, played by Larry Miller, threw this enormous, elaborate bar mitzvah for his son on a cruise ship. It was Titanic-themed.
Did the ship sink?
No, but they did have like an entire floor show with an iceberg, and the kid comes out on the front of a boat and says, you know, I'm king of the bar mitzvah or something. I can't remember what it was. But and all of that sounds much funnier than it is.
Uh-huh.
Trust me, it's a premise in search of a script and a director. Gary Marshall is actually in the film. He plays the grandpa. The kid doesn't want the big bar mitzvah. He arranges for his wacky grandpa to come to visit. Dad and grandpa have been estranged. You can kind of see what's going to happen here where, you know, they butt heads, but then Aaron, everybody's friends at the end, and we have a big, fat Jewish bar mitzvah is basically the movie.
As opposed to the other kind.
It's a terrible movie. Terrible, terrible, terrible movie. I don't even know how many times I could say terrible to try and get across how terrible this movie is. This is what happens when you have a very famous father who's a very good director, and basically you are handed a major motion picture. This guy, Scott Marshall, God bless him, maybe a lovely, lovely man, but this is a guy who should have put in a few years in the trenches and learned to make a movie before he was given something of this scope. He can't direct. The script is awful. The jokes are awful. I don't know if he hates his father, but he has Gary Marshall saying things like, "What is this? Queer Eye for the Straight Goy?"
Ooh.
And that's the level of the humor for 2 hours.
And let me tell you, Don, it runs in the family. The Marshalls are awful.
Well, the thing is, even the movies that Gary Marshall makes that aren't great, he has wonderful stuff with his secondary characters, played by Hector Elizondo, Larry Miller, people like this. Larry Miller appears in this film, and he's given nothing good to do. His lines suck. This entire movie just is awful. Do not go see this movie. I gave it an F. It's horrible. It was painful to sit through. It's just a waste of celluloid, a waste of everyone's time, and I hope Scott Marshall is appropriately chastised and goes off and actually learns to make a film before somebody gives him money again.
Okay, so that was Keeping Up with the Steins. And I don't know whether to call this a segue or a double play here, but we're going into Nacho Libre. Nacho Libre, directed by a guy named Jared Hess, who directed the most mystifying cult film I have ever seen, Napoleon Dynamite. I have no idea why people think this movie is funny. I have no idea why people think that kid is funny, unless it makes them feel better that they're not as goofy and dorky as he is. But this is Nacho Libre, his second film. He now has money and a budget. And what does he do? He makes the worst movie I have seen this year. Witless, cliched, and stupid. You know exactly what's going to happen the minute the alleged plot is put into place. This movie is Rocky, set in a monastery in Mexico, basically. So you know exactly what's going to happen. Jack Black is in it. He's the only Anglo actor in an otherwise Hispanic cast. I think mostly Mexican. And he mugs his way through everything. If you stick Jack Black in front of a camera and say, you don't have anything to do except make a bunch of funny faces, we have an hour and a half of this. It's just gruesome. He's not helped by the fact that all the situations written by Hess and his brother are not funny. It's also not helped by the fact that Hess cannot direct the film. You know, just putting geeks in front of a camera and having them act goofy doesn't work the second time, at least not here. This is a complete waste of time and money. Do not go see this movie. I gave this movie an F, and I think that Jared Hess should be locked up. Dawn, you saw this also.
I did see this film, too. And comedy is very subjective, and I loved Napoleon Dynamite.
Right.
I am one of the people who loved that film. And I came into this thinking, I saw the trailer and thought the trailer looked a little tepid, but I was willing to give it the benefit of the doubt. I mean, I loved Napoleon Dynamite. It's co-written by Mike White, who wrote Chuck and Buck, and he directed The Good Girl and School of Rock, which were all very good films. Unfortunately, he also wrote Orange County, if you saw that piece of dreck. And this film is in that same category there. It's a movie about Mexican wrestlers in which I don't believe any of these people have ever seen any Mexican wrestling films, which are a genre unto themselves and ripe for satire. Nothing in this film is funny. Nothing in this film is funny. I love Jack Black when he has good direction. He's given something to do, but he mostly just prances around and dances and makes funny faces and does goofy things and tries desperately, I think, to wring some humor out of this movie where there is none. To their credit, Jared Hess does some interesting things with the camera. He sets up some really terrifically framed shots, beautifully photographed. static shots of people coming in and out of the frame, very much like Wes Anderson. And he also does some interesting music choices, like Wes Anderson did in like The Life Aquatic and The Royal Tenenbaums. But what ends up happening is you have essentially a Wes Anderson film without any of the stuff that made Wes Anderson clever, anything that makes it funny or interesting or worth watching. It's just awful. You're right. We sat there. I was sitting a couple of seats away from you, and I did not laugh once in this entire film.
There was one sublime 10 seconds in the film where Jack Black sings a song.
Yeah.
And you get a glimpse there of what Jack Black is capable of, because he probably wrote that little song himself. He's, you know, as a half of Tenacious D. We know that he can write funny stuff. And it was all the more glaring for the fact that there was nothing that preceding it and nothing following it.
There was one moment when one of the guys is in a fight, and he has a corn cob on a stick, and he throws it at somebody, and it jams in the guy's eye, and he screams, and he's got a corn cob sticking out of his eye. And I do believe I chuckled.
Well, that's a funny visual.
And
yeah.
When that is the high point of humor, a guy getting a piece of corn in his eye.
An ear in his eye.
Not a good movie. I gave it an F. Stay away.
Isn't it awful when you have to give two movies an F?
Yes.
And one, it really is.
Especially
very depressing.
When they're both supposed to be comedies.
Yeah. Okay, we only have about 4 minutes left. Give us a quickie on The Omen, the new Omen.
New Omen is a movie that exists only because the date 6606 was coming up, and they felt they wanted, hey, we can remake The Omen and stick it in the theaters. It's really not terrible.
There's a ringing endorsement.
They use the same script as the original, with very few changes. The changes that are made are actually better. Directed by John Moore, who did Flight of the Phoenix and Behind Enemy Lines. He's a very good, competent director. Julia Stiles plays the mom. She is much better than Lee Remick. Liev Schreiber plays the dad. He is much worse than Gregory Peck, but then how could he help but be worse than Gregory
Peck? The
one
that I'm interested in is Billy Whitelaw versus Mia Farrow. Because Billy Whitelaw was the evil nurse. And
Mia Farrow's pretty interesting. Even better is the creepy priest guy is played by Pete Postlethwaite.
Oh, great. Perfect.
And he is very creepy.
Perfect.
And he's very good. It's pretty good. The thing is, the original movie wasn't that great. So
it was very scary, though.
It was at the time. But to modern audiences, we had Mike Russell from The Oregonian and my friend Eric Snyder, who's a writer for Willamette Week. We all got together at my house and watched The Omen before we went to the theater to see the new one. And they are almost identical. The scripts are almost identical. Special effects are better. Better decapitation technology these days than they had back in the day. So it's not bad. I give it a B. It's certainly a little bit better than the first one, and the first one was not terrible. So,
okay. Before we do the recap, if anybody wants to get hold of us, the email address is kbumovietalk@yahoo.com. kbumovietalk@yahoo.com. What do you got?
DVDs?
Yes, yeah. Doug.
Very quickly, tell you what new DVDs are this week. Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, a Russ Meyer movie. Finally, a Russ Meyer movie getting a good release. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang comes
Hooray!
Up. As many of us
Excellent
thought that was
movie.
The best movie of last year. And finally, if you want to know everything there is to know about the first Omen, you can pick up the 2-disc Omen DVD that it tells you every single thing that you would ever want to know about this movie. Now, it took me 3 days to watch it.
You watch the extras on DVDs generally, right?
I do.
What about Kiss Kiss Bang Bang? Anything fun on that?
I don't have that one yet. Don, did you pick it up yesterday?
No, I was beaten out on that. At the DVD Journal, DVDjournal.com.
If you haven't seen Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and The Ice Harvest, two of my favorite films of last year. Okay, we started out with An Inconvenient Truth. I think it's definitely worth seeing, but for KBU people, it's a given. At the Lake House?
Not bad, B.
Okay. The Breakup?
Also not bad. I gave it a B.
Okay.
Well.
Evil, we liked Evil, too.
Yes.
We thought it was a worthy film.
You and I liked it a little bit better than Doug.
Yeah, but we're all in the B grades.
Yeah.
Black Ball, the Bobby Duke story?
C-plus movie.
Okay, and 2 F movies.
Yes.
Keeping Up with the Steins and The Execrable.
F for Stay Nacho Far, Libre. Far, Far Away.
Man, this is in Eight Heads with a Duffel Bag territory. It's really, The Omen, the new Omen.
Give it a B.
Give
not
it a B.
Bad.
We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Good to be back. And thank you, Dawn, and thank you, Doug.
You're welcome.
coming up next, we'll hear a recent talk in Portland by Father Roy Burgoyce of the School of the Americas Watch. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller addresses the issues of network neutrality with Janine Kenny. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, journalist Dar Jamil discusses the killing of two pregnant Iraqi women and how the U.S. military may have tried to cover it up, and Greg Palast talks about the disenfranchisement of black voters. In this segment of the Radio Zine, we're going to hear a segment of a talk by Father Roy Burgoyce of the School of the Americas Watch. He spoke in Portland on May 6th at St. Francis Church in Southeast Portland. He talked about the beginnings of his anti-war work and his fight to close the School of the Americas. And we'd like to thank Charlie Holsinger for recording this. And here it is, Father Roy Burgoyce.
It took me a while to learn lessons from Vietnam. Years later, and just yesterday, I was at a high school in outside of Seattle. And whenever I speak to students now, I feel this responsibility to talk about options, to make sure that they understand when those recruiters come into their school, they know they have an option. I don't remember anyone challenging me and saying I had an option back then. Being sent off to war is serious business. Nothing could be more serious, because we may end up killing another human being. And we've got to ask a basic question: can we do that? Are we willing to die for this cause, knowing that our death will cause so much grieving and pain and suffering to our loved ones back home? Are we prepared to put them through that? And what I say to the students also, know that those who are sending you to this war will not go. The architects of the war will remain in their comfortable homes and offices. They will use the macho talk: we've got to be tough, we have to sacrifice, stay the course. But when they say we, they're meaning you, others. They will not go, nor will their sons and daughters go. And I think we have to, wherever there's that opportunity, especially in high schools, we should put our tables right next to those recruiters in the high schools and at those universities, and let students know there is a choice to be made here. We can say no. And there are models for us. The two models I use in my talks there yesterday and throughout the country to students. There's Camilo Mejia, who was in the army for 6 years, was being sent back to Iraq for his second tour, and simply said, no, I'm not going back. I have seen too many killed, including children, and I refuse to participate in this war. It's immoral. It's wrong. He was court-martialed, and he was sent to prison for a year. And what he said, it took more courage to go to prison than to go off to that war. And Camilo is a model for students, I feel. Along with Catherine Shashinsky, who I've come to know recently. She's 23 years old. She's a soldier at Fort Benning. Her unit arrived from Texas to learn weapons training to be shipped off to Iraq. And it was during her weapons training out on that firing range, she had really thought seriously whether she could take the life of another human being. She thought it through. And so many soldiers, she said, that simply, we do not do this until we're actually in Iraq or in Vietnam. But she thought it through, and she came to the conclusion, no, I cannot do this. I cannot take the life of a fellow human being. And she informed her superior officer, I cannot participate in this war. They're getting ready to court-martial her, and she, like Camilo and others, she's saying that I'm willing to go to prison. And I mention Camilo and Catherine because I think they are models for us today in the struggle for peace, especially when it comes to this madness, this war in Iraq. I came home from Vietnam so grateful to be alive, to be back in Louisiana with family and friends, when that airplane filled with soldiers, touched down as we came back from Vietnam, touched down in California. Many of us wept because we were alive. And I wanted to try and be a peacemaker, whatever that meant. I entered the Maryknoll Order, sort of led there by an army chaplain in Vietnam. A group working in 28 countries around the world, serving the poor. I spent these comfortable years in seminaries out east, was challenged. Those were good years. I was finally ordained and now assigned to our missions in Bolivia, where this slum on the outskirts of La Paz became my home for the next 5 years. And it was here that I was educated by the poor. They became my teachers, and that's the way it works. When we dare to put our feet in the culture of another, sisters and brothers who are oppressed, who are struggling, we have a lot to learn, and they will teach us if we're open. The vast majority of the people of Bolivia, as throughout Latin America and the developing world, as we know, are struggling for survival. They're living in those shacks without running water. They don't have electricity. They don't have schools for their children. They do not receive a living wage for their labor. They see their kids go to bed hungry at night. And when they're sick, there are no hospitals or clinics to go to get those needed medicines. They taught me about my country's foreign policy. It saddened me to see my country in Bolivia supporting, propping up this brutal dictator, General Hugo Banzer, who came into power through a violent coup. And throughout the country were the men with the guns, the bullies, the thugs. They ran the country. They defended that socioeconomic system there that kept this small elite very wealthy and powerful and the vast majority very poor. And the large corporations were there as they're coming in today, the multinationals. They're seeking profits. Where are there huge profits to be made in these developing countries like El Salvador and Guatemala, Colombia, Bolivia, and so many other countries? By exploiting the cheap labor and exploiting those vast resources, there are huge profits to be made. In Latin America, these corporations are seen as the new conquistadors, as they came in the 16th century to exploit. They're arriving today to do the same thing, to exploit people and resources. And what do people do under conditions such as this, day in and day out, year in and year out? They say, basta, enough. We are not going to live like this forever. So many are empowered by their faith, liberated by their education, and they start coming together there at the university and the tin mines and the factories on the streets. They come together and talk about justice, about food for the table, a living wage, schools and hospitals. This is really what this struggle is all about. This is the starting point. And when they do this, it's high risk, as we know. It's dangerous. Many are killed. Many are forced to flee the country and their families. They go into hiding. Many are arrested and tortured, disappeared. It was in my fifth year, I was among a group that was arrested, and I was forced out of the country. I came home. It was a very difficult and lonely time. I didn't know what to do. I tried to get back. I was denied a visa. And not long after coming back from Bolivia, with many others, I went to El Salvador, a country far worse than the one I came from. In El Salvador, there was Archbishop Oscar Romero that called so much attention to this little country of 5 million. He was assassinated. The reason he was killed was because he loved the poor and tried to defend them. Not long after he was killed, there were four church women who went there at his invitation to work with the poor. There were four church women who went there, and they were raped and killed by the Salvadoran military. Two of them were friends of the Mirano community, Maura Clark and Edith Ford. Also with them was a nun from Cleveland, an Ursuline, Dorothy Kazel, and lay missioner Jean Donovan. When this happened to the four church women, it brought El Salvador closer to home. When we went to El Salvador, we found what they found, this microcosm of Latin America. We also found our country, the United States, once again deeply involved here, giving guns and training to those soldiers who were doing the killing, at war with their people. And this was a crime against humanity. Many came back from El Salvador, and we couldn't shut up. We had to speak out against this military aid and what it was doing, all in our name, paid for by our taxes. I was giving speaking tours around the country with others, and when we learned that 525 soldiers had just arrived at Fort Benning from El Salvador, Salvadoran soldiers now in our backyard, learning the art of killing, knowing what this meant, I and friends headed to Fort Benning. We found this little house in the community called El Casa Romero and started organizing, giving talks at different universities like Auburn and other places, whoever would listen to us, a few churches who opened up their doors to us. And then three of us decided to take the message to the Salvadoran soldiers on Fort Benning. In our little group of three, there was Linda Ventimiglia, who trained at Fort Benning, who is now in the Army Reserves. Larry Rosebaum, an oblate priest who had just come back from his work in Brazil, and I. We went down to this Army surplus place, Ranger Joe's. We bought ourselves these Army uniforms. A few nights later, we entered Fort Benning dressed as high-ranking Army officers. My only regret is I went in as a lieutenant colonel and not as a general. We entered carrying this very powerful boombox, and in it was the last sermon in Spanish of Bishop Romero. The sermon he gave at the cathedral the day before he was assassinated, where he made a special plea to the men in the military, saying to those soldiers, stop the killing. Lay down your weapons. Disobey your superior officers telling you to kill your fellow campesinos. And obey a higher law, the law of God that says, thou shalt not kill. I tell you, Romero was, he was something. So many people have been inspired by him. I think it's because he's so much like us. He was not known for his courage or his wisdom or his commitment to the poor. Actually, he was a very silent priest. He was aloof. He never spoke out about peace and justice or the poor. And that's why they made him a bishop. But little did they know that Bishop Romero was going to change, as we all have this potential to change. And what happened was not complicated. His people were killed, many of them slaughtered. And he said, I have to speak for them because they are voiceless, they are powerless. And I have a voice. I'm a bishop. I have power. And I will speak out. And when he began to speak out clearly and boldly, the death threats came. But he kept his hands on the plow. His friend said, Oscar, you have to leave the country. Let things cool off. And he said, no, I cannot abandon my people. And sure enough, he was silenced by this assassin's bullet while saying Mass the day after his plea to the military. And he has inspired so many, and he inspired us that night. We were scared, Linda, Larry, and I, when we entered Fort Benning with his last sermon. We penetrated this high security area. We got saluted. It was a very shaky salute. Went way up into the woods where the Salvadorans were housed in these barracks. That night, we scaled this tall pine tree and lashed it down. And we waited. And about 11 o'clock at night, when the last lights went out, he said, "Bishop Romero, this is for you, brother." And his voice just boomed into the barracks. They were pretty upset with us. It was like poking a beehive. We really saw this as a very sacred moment. They didn't quite see it that way. And they came out of their barracks, those instructors, the soldiers with their guns, their dogs, the lights, spotless in the tree, and they said, "We will come down or they will shoot us down." And it was time to come down. But left the boom box up there with this message repeated a number of times. The handcuff just worked us over. We had no identification on us other than on that in our Army uniforms. You have your last name. Linda had the name of Donovan, representing Jean Donovan, one of the church women killed. Larry had the name of Grandi, representing Rutilio Grandi, a Jesuit that was killed. And I had the name of Romero. And they brought in the FBI, and they separated us and drilled us. "Who are you? What are you doing here? How many are you?" And we just gave that name. Just gave that name and said, "You should know us. You are responsible for our death in El Salvador." Meanwhile, they were combing that wooded area with a lot of soldiers, thinking we had a big operation going on. They brought us to the county jail, giving up on the questioning, and then to trial before this judge who we got to know well over the years as Maximum Bob. He didn't like protesters. He had sent many civil rights leaders to jail down there in Georgia, well-known segregationists. And in that courtroom that day, our loved ones were there, friends, and we wanted so much to talk about why we did what we did. We also wanted to put our country on trial for what we were doing to the people in El Salvador. But it wasn't possible. Every time we talked about the churchwomen or Bishop Romero, the poor who were being killed with our aid, the judge would come down with that gavel and say, "Irrelevant." We were sent to prison for a year and a half, and many of us now have been to prison, and we know one thing, that it cannot silence us. The truth cannot be silenced, and we spoke from our prisons. Hundreds and hundreds of letters we wrote to the newspapers, had many media interviews, trying to educate people in our country who really had no idea what we were doing in El Salvador and other countries. When we got out of prison, our hope was intact. The joy was there. And we went back to work, joining thousands all over the country, many here in Portland, trying to stop that military aid to El Salvador. That got up to $1 million a day. Again, all from our taxes. But we couldn't stop it. Our voices were not strong enough. The bloodshed continued. November the 16th, 1989, they went after the Jesuits. They were very angry with the Jesuits. 2 days ago, I was in Seattle talking at Seattle University, one of the many Jesuit universities around the country. There are 28 in all, many high schools. The Jesuits in El Salvador, they were educators, educating not only their students but the world about what was going on there. They were critics of U.S. foreign policy. They called it by its right name, idolatry, the worship of the false gods of power and wealth. The Jesuits went a step further. They began to name those institutions and individuals who were worshiping the gods of power and wealth. And that's when they crossed the line. They, like Bishop Romero, got the death threats. And their friends said, too, you got to leave, you got to leave. And like Bishop Romero, they said, no, no. I've got to stay the course. Where are we to go? Our people need us. Knowing the implications of their education, what they were saying, writing about, preaching about. And the military entered their campus after midnight that November the 16th, dragged out of their rooms these six Jesuits. With them, their co-worker, a young mother, Elba Ramos, and her 15-year-old daughter, Selena. And they were shot at close range, each of them, massacred. And this hit the front pages of newspapers all over the world. It angered many of our members of Congress, many of them educated by the Jesuits. They decided to send a congressional task force to El Salvador to investigate. They come back, this congressional task force, reporting that those responsible, those who did the killing, were trained in the United States in our backyard at a big army base down in Georgia called Fort Benning, at a school called the U.S. Army School of the Americas. When I read that report, along with friends, we knew this was serious stuff. And we knew very little about this school. I went down to Georgia with the blessing and support of my Marino community. And right outside of the main gate, I found this little apartment. A soldier had just been transferred. Rent $175 a month. Beats Portland, I think. I moved in and cleaned it up. This became our SOA watch, and friends came into town. Kathy Kelly came in from Chicago. Many of you know Kathy, who went on to co-found Voices in the Wilderness, who today is back in Iraq. Charlie Litke came in from San Francisco, a Vietnam veteran, recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor. A Jesuit joined us from Boston, two Dominicans, three Salvadoran university students who had to flee their country with death threats and others. We came together for a three-day retreat, reflecting, talking. What are we to do? What are we going to do? And at this Mexican restaurant, that night, over a nice meal, we decided on a fast. Never plan a fast at a restaurant. Especially a good restaurant. It seemed like a good idea at the time. We decided on a very serious water-only fast. And we're going to take it a day at a time. We're going to camp out at the main gate of Fort Benning. Our very first action to try and expose this school of the Americas, well known as the School of Assassins. We're going to expose this issue to the public and to the media. It was difficult. We realized, too, that our fast was voluntary. We could end it at any time. And our sisters and brothers in Latin America and throughout the world, there for them, the fast is mandatory. They cannot do what we were going to do and end at any time. It went 35 days. Our bodies grew weak, but I must say the spirit was strong. And every day around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we would have just time to come, to gather. People would bring their music, their poetry, a prayer. It was a time to uplift the spirit. A few soldiers would join us every now and then. We started to build a little community and some resistance. The fast ended and we had to get to work. There was so much we didn't know about the school, and through the Freedom of Information Act, helped along by members of Congress, Amnesty International and others, what we learned was serious. This school had been around a long time, had trained over 50,000 soldiers from 18 countries in Latin America. About 1,200 a year were arriving, most of them today coming in from Colombia. They come here to learn how to be commandos. They learn psychological warfare, counterinsurgency. The big question, who are the insurgents, we ask. They are who they've always been in Latin America. They are the poor. There are labor leaders, as in Colombia and Guatemala and El Salvador. There are health care advocates, religious leaders like Bishop Romero and the Jesuits and the churchwomen. There are the campesinos who call for a living wage and land reform. They have been the targets, we learned, the targets of those who were training here. And then we learned about the torture manuals that made the front page of the Washington Post. They found at this school in the curriculum manuals that advocated torture, executions, and kidnappings. Dictators went through here. General Manuel Noriega from Panama, today in a federal prison in Miami doing 25 years for drug running. Death squad leaders trained here like Roberto Dubasan from El Salvador. General Hugo Banzer from Bolivia. This thug was not only a graduate, but in 1988, he was inducted into the school's Hall of Fame, where his photograph was on the wall with 20 other generals presented as model soldiers. When the United Nations Truth Commission report on El Salvador was made public and got a lot of press, they documented, this report documented, that those who assassinated Bishop Romero trained here. Those who raped and killed the churchwomen were graduates. The 28 who killed the Jesuits and the two women, 19 of them graduates. And there was Elmo Sote that many of you know of, where over 900 unarmed civilians, including many women, men, over 100 children in this remote village of El Salvador were massacred. Of the 12 responsible, 10 of them graduates of this school. As word began to spread around the country about this school down in Georgia, something began to happen. People began to say, I want to do something about this. I'm convinced that when we have the information, the knowledge, that compassion that we have in our hearts and our cells, it will surface. And it started to surface. And we gathered in November now at the main gate. That first November, calling for its closure, were 10 of us. The next year, 100 came. The next year, 500, and then 1,000. This last November, over 19,000 gathered at the main gate. When we gather, it's this big celebration of hope. We come in from Portland to New York, from Chicago to New Orleans, of all ages. Over half who gathered were college students, high school students. A lot of veterans are there, calling this issue for what it is, bringing shame to our country.
You've been listening to Father Roy Bourgeois of the School of America's Watch. That was recorded on May 6th at St. Francis' Church in Southeast Portland here by Charlie Holzfussig. Coming up next is People Rise Up with Andrew Geller. And he will be talking about network neutrality with Janine Kenny, Senior Policy Analyst with Consumers Union. And at 11, Democracy Now!, journalist Dar Jamil discusses the killing of the two pregnant Iraqi women and how the U.S. military may have tried to cover it up. And Greg Palast talks about the disenfranchisement of black voters. Stay tuned to KBOO Portland.
The time is 10 a.m. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. Coming up next, People Rise Up.